Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. The video you're about to see is a discussion between myself and a young white guy in Kansas. And his topic of interest is Rhodesia. And he's watched many of the videos that I've done about Rhodesia, including my talk that I gave in Canada in 2019. So being a young American and trying to grasp all these strange things that went on in this obscure part of Africa, with all these different strange countries and strange peoples who live in these places, it is quite a job for someone to grasp all of what's going on. But I did appreciate the fact that he has a real interest in it. And I noticed in one of his other shows that he did that he always has a Rhodesian flag behind him. So the core topic of this discussion was, why did the whites of Rhodesia rebel? And depending on how much detail you go into, it can get quite complicated. And even though I had viewpoints on these things in the past, the fact is that these things took place when I was a baby. So I actually don't know the finer detail. It's not like I was able to hear it on the radio or see it on TV. It happened, many of these things happened even before I was born. Now, the lecture that I gave in America and Canada in 2019 was based on a bunch of research and updating of my own information that I did in 2018. I must have spent more than 2 months just doing nothing but sitting and going through things and gathering photos and getting data to try and put together some kind of talk about the history of the whites of Southern Africa in recent times. That particular talk was called 50 Years of Race War in Southern Africa. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to rush through lots and lots and lots of topics in a period of 2 hours. I was pleased, therefore, to hear from this young guy that he had actually watched it a number of times and that he's watched various videos that I've done and he's fascinated by the topic of Rhodesia and the whites of Southern Africa. But since 2018, I am nowadays busy with even deeper dives into the history of the whites of Southern Africa because I discovered many things that I didn't really know that much about. The big focus was uncovering stuff about the Portuguese. But since then, I've uncovered a lot more. And there's a lot more that's coming that I've been working on that's sitting in the pipeline, and I'm starting to delve into even more complex aspects of what happened. So in the past, I would have just said, well, the whites of Rhodesia decided that they weren't going to hand over to the blacks, and that is why UDI happened. But in actual fact, the discussions around UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, which basically was rebellion, it was basically rebellion against Britain, straight off. It was nothing more than that and nothing less than that. Outright rebellion. And it was illegal, and the whites who did it could easily have been arrested. They could have been attacked by the British, but some of those things didn't occur. And I have been answering in other videos the reasons why some of these things didn't occur. Because it's only in recent years that I can now say definitively why certain things didn't occur. And then there are things that happened that I didn't even know had happened that are just weird or creepy. For example, the whole business of a black nation in Africa asking the British to send the Royal Air Force to come and protect them from white racists in the neighboring state. So I'm busy with all kinds of research relating to either South Africa or the Portuguese or Rhodesia, and there are still many more videos to come because I'm trying to grasp finer points of certain aspects of what's going on. I've got questions that are popping into my head and I'm trying to answer them now and I'm trying to get to the root of it. And while I'm busy doing some research here, then I stumble on something else that I never heard of before. Like, just yesterday, I was busy going through the memoirs of Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia and the prime character in this whole rebellion, only to discover that Ian Smith suddenly mentions Jan Smuts. Who's Jan Smuts, you might say? Jan Smuts is not a name that I use often, and in South Africa, Boers don't like the name Jan Smuts. Well, General Jan Smuts was a very high-powered character in South Africa 100 years ago. Jan Smuts ruled South Africa. Jan Smuts was a great friend of Winston Churchill. Jan Smuts was on the world stage 100 years ago in the same way that Nelson Mandela, the communist terrorist Nelson Mandela, was on the world stage a few decades ago. So I was reading something that Ian Smith wrote about Jan Smuts that really made me sit up and think again. Here I was picking up something that I'd never heard of before. And all of these things that I'm looking for and hunting around have to do with whites. It has to do with whites and what whites got up to and the ideas and strategies that whites had. So when it comes to the issue of how exactly did the Rhodesians come to want to rebel against Britain, depending on the level of detail that you want, it can become literally a whole book just by itself. But most of it is just a bunch of diplomatic talk back and forth and that kind of thing. Ian Smith regarded it as the great betrayal, that Britain betrayed Rhodesia and should have given Rhodesia independence. But the deeper issue is that Rhodesia is ruled by whites, whereas all these other countries are going to be ruled by non-whites. And then there's the mysterious problem of why did the British come up with this idea of the federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland? The more I look into that thing, the more I think that there's something more sophisticated going on there. And on the screen in front of you, on the left, is a map of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. And the photo of the young guy on the right, that is the guy in Kansas I was speaking to. He's got a BitChute channel called Kansas Hemp Man. Anyway, in this discussion, we end up also getting sidetracked and talking about some other things. One thing that I just want to mention here is that the Tuskegee Airmen come up. For those outside America who might not have heard of the Tuskegee Airmen, these are blacks who were pilots, fighter pilots in World War II. And I remember my Jewish pal telling me about the Tuskegee Airmen. And he was saying, oh, well, you know, these black guys, they could go and fight against the Germans in fighter aircraft. Typical Jewish crap that I heard in my own home from my best Jewish friend. When I'm busy making the argument that whites are better at technical things and technology, then suddenly the Jew is there, and the Jew was, oh, no, there were these Tuskegee Airmen, and they could fight the Germans in the air just as good as the white Americans could. Well, that's the crap that my Jewish friend was busy ramming down my throat in the days when I still used to talk to him. This was before I became Jew-wise. And so we discussed the Tuskegee Airmen and another bunch of blacks as well. But I want to tell you something that I was told in America. When I was in America in 2019, I met Captain Bernie Davids. Captain Bernie Davids, in his youth, had been in George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party. And one day, when I was talking to Captain Bernie Davids, the topic of the Tuskegee Airmen came up. I think I may have even brought it up. And then Captain Bernie Davids told me something that you won't easily find these days. Captain Bernie Davids said to me that those black pilots, that squadron of black pilots that would go into battle against the Germans, that behind them was a squadron of white pilots whose job it was to protect them. So that is from Captain Bernie Davids, and Captain Bernie Davids knew what he was talking about. I was in his house. I spent quite a long time with him, and he had a huge library. I only saw the last remnants of his library, but he had an amazing library that he'd gathered together during his whole life. It filled an entire shipping container. I'm not joking with you. He had a library that filled an entire shipping container. One of those containers that goes on ships. The whole thing was filled with books and magazines. He had the most amazing collection of books I've ever seen. So if Captain Bernie David says that's what happened, then I totally believe him. If anyone can ever find more about that, then I'd appreciate that. But you must know that Jews are running around removing stuff everywhere the hell they can as they are busy hiding all kinds of facts from history. So that issue about the Tuskegee Airmen having to be protected by a whole squadron of white American airmen, all these worthless blacks who fought for America against the Germans, and then the Americans now in modern times having to pretend how good those blacks were. Just be aware, there's a bunch of garbage going on there. And you'll hear this guy talking about other blacks that I'd not heard of. I assume that these were black troops on the ground. Anyway, here's the discussion between myself and this young American.
Hello and good evening to all. Thank you for joining me here on my channel, Kansas Hetman. I am pleased to have the opportunity to finally introduce my guest for a highly anticipated discussion. He is a man held in such high regards by others that he was invited to spend time personally with the former Prime Minister of South Africa, P.W. Botha. A very busy man, his in-depth coverage of many crucial and oftentimes hidden and buried topics have garnered many influential people's attention. It isn't only the topics of which he covers, but the manner of which he presents and his ability to get you involved intrinsically in the story is what makes him so distinctly different from others. As a matter of fact, it seems just like yesterday I heard one of his discussions for the first time, and it's only snowballed from there. He constantly is being hounded and harassed by the entities that have been plaguing humanity for decades, if not forever, which is exactly why we should all be taking part in his perspectives and following his fight. We take for granted our freedom of speech here stateside and seem to forget that the slightest misstep in modern South Africa and to a certain extent Australia and Canada can land you in serious legal trouble. Now, it is for my privilege to welcome my guest for our multi-part discussion, author Jan Lamprecht. Jan, how you doing down there? How you holding up?
Hi there, Chris. It's an honor to be on your show, and that was a really nice introduction. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, I'm finally it's been ecstatic to have you on. We've been exchanging emails. You're a very busy individual. I'm honored that I've garnered your attention. That I'm just happy to have you here, and several people are happy to have an interview. So Jan, you're actually a Rhode you're from you were born in Rhodesia, correct?
Yes, correct. I was born in Salisbury, Rhodesia, which was the capital. It's now known by the disgusting name of Harare. And that's like Harare was the name of the township, the black township next to Salisbury. So that's like calling Johannesburg Soweto. And so for me, the real city was Salisbury.
That's like renaming New York City to Harlem, or
Yes, you're dead on.
isn't that something else? And I was studying the map a few days ago, and that it's a real disgusting state of affairs in Zimbabwe. So disgusting, as a matter of fact, that they've been wanting white farmers back there, and they've been begging them over the last 5, 6 years to come back. But it's such a sad affair over there. And how are you enjoying things in modern South Africa? How are things going?
South Africa is nothing like it used to be, and it's very disgusting to live here. And I must tell you that if it wasn't that I'm doing the things that I'm doing, I'd probably have either lost my mind or just jumped on a plane and got the hell out of here a long time ago. If it wasn't that I have a certain belief that I can still assist people here, I wouldn't even waste my time here. This is not where you want to be. And this is the place where you know who is taking all of you in America and elsewhere. You're going to end up, I've said before that we're all Americans now in many ways, but we will all become South Africans. All whites will eventually end up as South Africans, given enough time.
Yeah, I've heard you mention that before, and your book, Government by Deception, is kind of a South a white South Southern Rhodesians, or excuse me, a white South Africans' warning to the rest of the world as to what's going to happen and what could happen. And that book got you a lot of good publicity. P.W. Botha read your book, and he was very pleased by it, by what he read, supposedly, right?
Yes, when I wrote that book, the reason for writing it originally was not quite as a warning to the world, but as specifically as a warning to white South Africans, to say to them that because white South Africans were being fooled into believing that South Africa's different and successful and it's taken a different path and it's going to do better than Zimbabwe. So at the time that I wrote it, which was in the years 2000 to 2001, I actually dared to stand up in the midst of all this liberalism with Jews and white liberals and blacks, and they were all saying, no, South Africa, the new South Africa is great. And I dared to stand up and say, you know what? South Africa is going to end up like Zimbabwe. And that was the nasty message in that book. And I had to market it myself, and I struggled a lot. Hey? They were trying to stop my book. I paid for the publication of my book. I didn't have anyone who was willing to finance it. I paid for it. In fact, I published a version of it in America, and I only printed 350 copies in America. And I myself don't have a copy of those original copies. And if you can ever get hold of them, you've got a collector's item. They are Government by Deception, but with Nelson Mandela's face on it. And I couldn't do that in South Africa, so I had to change the cover to put Robert Mugabe's face on it. And when I did it in South Africa,
Oh.
I could publish more.
That's funny you bring that up. I searched your book for sale, and there's paperback copies with Nelson Mandela on the front, used for about 40 to 50 bucks. Maybe I should be buying as many of those as I can. I didn't realize how collectible they were.
There are only 350 of them, and I don't have a copy. So if you do get one, I'll buy one from you. I'm not joking. I'm
No
not.
Zim dollars.
But yeah, so I had to struggle. I couldn't get any marketing done. I even wanted to try and pay for radio ads on. I've even got an Afrikaans radio advert that someone did for me. But the radio stations wouldn't run it. Nobody. I couldn't, even if I paid for adverts in the newspapers, they didn't want to advertise my book. I had to market it myself. That's how it worked. I literally had to put it on my website and try and spread it myself. And I did manage to find one or two bookstores that were willing to sell it. And I even had, there was a branch of a store in Cape Town where the quotes whites, the rich whites in the suburb, came and said they must remove my book from the bookstore. So let me tell you, from the beginning where I stood up and I said, South Africa is going to become another Zimbabwe, I was taking heat right from the beginning. They did not like that message. Nobody wanted to hear that freaking message.
Wow. Were you able to record an audio version of your book?
What I did about a year ago is I did do like an automated audio version of the book, But because I didn't do it well, there are some letters and things in there that come out badly. But yes, there is such a thing. I can later look at cleaning it up and redoing it if people are truly interested. But I did put up a quick one, and you'll find it on my website and on BitChute.
Oh, very good. I bet people would be very interested in an audio version of that. Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I hope to eventually, now that I know that's collectible, it's probably going to hurry my purchase up of buying your book. But if I get a couple extra ones, I'm sure I'll mail it down to you for all your efforts. You won't need to pay me. So a little bit back to your background here. You're born in Salisbury, Rhodesia. And you moved, obviously, willingly. Your family moved out after the fall of in 81, and you've been in South Africa ever since. Is there anything you'd want to talk about your childhood or what you remember about Rhodesia as just personally or anything like that?
Yeah, there are some things that I could mention. You know, the Rhodesian society was basically a British society, and there were Afrikaans people there, like there were Boers there, and it's been quite an interesting thing to try and figure out what percentage of the Rhodesian population was actually Afrikaans. My best guess is that it was about 10%, maybe even a bit more. There are some places where I've seen that there were quite a lot of Afrikaans people there. When I go back and I look at some of the photographs and, like, for example, old schools. But mostly Rhodesia was basically British. And so you grow up in this English, totally British society where everything runs the way that the British are used to. The thing that I liked the most. That I like the most about Rhodesia, that even J.B. Campbell brought up whenever he talks about Rhodesia, is that in the time of the struggles and the war and the strife, the greatest thing about the Rhodesians was their spirit. The spirit of Rhodesians towards each other, the whites of Rhodesia towards each other, yes. We've got enemies, we've got problems, there's this thing happening, that thing happening, but we're all in it together. That spirit was a wonderful spirit, and it's something that you don't find anywhere at all these days. Even in South Africa did not have the same kind of spirit. It had something of that among the Afrikaans people when I got here. But in Rhodesia, it was a much more pronounced thing. I think that the last time there were any whites who had that kind of spirit, and maybe even a better spirit, was the Germans in Germany in World War II. But I want to tell you that I cannot tell you how lovely it is to be in a society where the good and the bad and the dangers and the threats. That everyone feels that, you know, we are in it together, and our future and our destiny, whether it goes up or whether it goes down, it's together. And we're sticking together and we're fighting together. That to me was one of the greatest parts of Rhodesia. And when I look at how much people complain and whine and bitch and argue in other countries, then I think to myself, man, you know, it's so sad that there aren't whites that are sticking together and knowing what it feels like, because it's a wonderful spirit. And of course, the Rhodesians after the event will tell you, well, you know, we weren't really racist, etc. But let me tell you, between you and me, when you were there, you knew that it's really the whites driving this show, and it's all about whites remaining in charge. And that for me was the greatest thing. And anyone who denies the racism, just go and look at those short excerpts from Ian Smith where he says, there won't be black rule in this country in 1,000 years. You know, there he says it right in your freaking face. and they even come and ask him about it, and he says it's a fair comment. Yes, because the reality is, no matter how much in the decades later now, all these Rhodesian whites are pretending they weren't racist, they were racist. And let me just add a little bit to that, because this topic comes up a lot. And Rhodesians, there are still Rhodesian communities out there, and they do still talk. I've even been looking through the memoirs of Ian Smith. And Ian Smith wrote his memoirs in the 1990s. So you must know, that is like, that is a long time after the handover of power. He wrote his memoirs about 15 years after Black Rule. So he was denying all kinds of things. But let me tell you something. In the reality, the Rhodesians were racist, but they hid their racism. Some of their racism could be hidden, but other racism was quite overt. Take, for example, the whole issue of the towns, Salisbury and Harare. There were lots of townships, and in those townships were only black people, blacks and coloureds. I think blacks and coloureds and maybe even Indians lived in those townships. Whites lived in their own suburbs, and when you lived in a white suburb, there were no black neighbours, no coloureds. They were not allowed in there. So don't be fooled by Rhodesians who try to say, oh, no, we were not really racist. In Ian Smith's book, for example, Ian Smith was saying that, unlike South Africa, black people could vote. Well, that is true, but it's also a clever kind of a truth, okay? There was this thing called voters' roll B, and blacks could vote, technically. In reality, for the blacks to get onto that roll, they had to have an education. They had to have gone through schooling up to a certain grade. There was a whole bunch of qualifications for blacks to get on that voters' roll. All the blacks could not get onto that voters' roll. And the black nationalists, as they call them, basically the black communists, but the black nationalists, as everyone else now calls them, they actually had a whole boycott of the voting. So the reality was that under white rule, there were a couple of blacks who were sitting in parliament, who were voted for, but it was just a tiny, tiny number of blacks. But the door is there, but it's a door that the blacks have got to work to get through. So, and the whites are not stupid. Those English whites are not stupid, okay? They put those rules and regulations are there to stop the blacks. They know that the minority whites will always dominate. They know it.
Yes. Yes, and, you know, as to say, to comment on what you said earlier in that statement, it sounded like the united understanding of the understanding of the united struggle that brought the people together to a really unbreakable nucleus, and that's really what it sounds about, you know, kind of what kept the morale high in Rhodesia. And sorry, you said a lot there. I had a few comments. But no, that is it's a lot to take in, and
It's a complex discussion, and there are things about Rhodesia, South Africa, and the Portuguese here that you've got to keep in mind. That even though we are whites living in Africa, we have got our own countries with their own rules. So the rules are slightly different in the different countries, and that also makes for an interesting analysis. And you'll see how useful it is when you dig into the deeper detail. That
I know that they were race realists, as they know that these people, you know, shouldn't give leadership positions to only the black, the best blacks. But I've never heard it been explained like that. So I was a little bit
caught you off
dumbfounded.
guard a bit there.
You caught me off guard there a little bit. Yeah, exactly. Now,
But the truth is, Chris, that if you look at the Parliament of Rhodesia, you'll see the whole freaking parliament was white. You'll see all the leaders are white males. And everybody knows that this is about whites ruling this country. That, we say we'll let some of the blacks in, but the whole issue really is about whites ruling that country.
And I see that as being appropriate, as Rhodesia is a white man's idea and achievement. Cecil Rhodes, no matter we can all question his doubts or his roots. It was established as a British colony, and I feel like that's kind of how it should have been. Doesn't offend me hearing that really, but in Rhodesia. Of course, just like South Africa, white and black interracial marriages were strictly outlawed, and extreme strict racial societal rules like that, correct?
There were things that were definitely like South Africa. For example, if I recall correctly, in Rhodesia, you had toilets for blacks and whites. If you went to public toilets, there were public toilets for whites and public toilets for blacks. I don't ever remember going into a public toilet and finding blacks there. There definitely was segregation. In fact, among the silly arguments that people use in different countries here in Southern Africa, there are some people on the Boer side, for example. There are some people on the Boer side who say things like this. They say, we Boers did not invent apartheid, and that apartheid was brought to us, that what came to be known as apartheid was actually something that the British brought. So they'll use the British as the excuse for racial segregation. And of course, and yes, it's true. All the British colonies were racist. All the Portuguese colonies were racist. Everybody was racist. They just had
And
slightly different rules and slightly different things.
the Indians kind of, coming from where they came from, they kind of fit right in there and didn't really see much problem with that, I would assume, because of their caste system. But
The
yeah.
Indians were treated, as best I recall, the Indians were treated like the blacks. In South
Oh.
Africa, the Indians were thrown into townships. Indians in South Africa had townships. I never recall in Rhodesia seeing Indians in white suburbs. White, the suburbs of Salisbury were white, period.
No, that's I wonder if they regret that simply because, I hear a lot of modern violence between South Africa, between the blacks and the Indians. It's hard keeping up with modern South Africa, but let's move on to the UDI here real quick and get into the 11th of November, and let's talk about what prompted the UDI and the British selling out and being broke after, selling out their race after World War II. Essentially, and what prompted the Rhodesian UDI. So,
Okay. In the case of Rhodesia, it's very interesting. Rhodesia was formed by Cecil Rhodes, but Rhodesia was actually created by a company, by a corporation. And the corporation was the British South Africa Company. And it was basically a company that was floated on the London Stock Exchange or whatever. So Rhodesia was the creation of this corporation owned by Cecil Rhodes. And the corpor and some of the aspects of that corporation meant it so it meant that this corporation basically rules the country. So the whites who went to Rhodesia were actually almost like employees or people brought in by the company. The original pioneers were brought in by the company, but the company actually ran the country. Then, after the whites had lived there for 10 or 20 years, then the whites wanted to start ruling the country. They didn't want the company to rule the country anymore. So that is how whites later on then started actually taking control of the country. And by 1923, a very important date in the history of Rhodesia is 1923. In 1923, after the whites had been ruling the country for a time, because of the British power and control over South Africa, there was a referendum in Rhodesia that the whites could either join South Africa as another state or they could continue ruling themselves. And they actually chose to rather rule themselves. It's a very interesting, fascinating what if they had chosen to become a part of South Africa. But anyhow, in 1923, they chose to rule themselves, and Britain gave them what was known as self-rule. So Britain would determine the foreign policy, but inside the country, the whites would run all the affairs of the country. So the whites run the whites are the parliament, the whites make the laws, the whites are the police, the army, the everything. So they rule themselves totally, and they started from 1923. It was like a very official arrangement, but it's very interesting how quickly things changed. You must remember that between 1920 and 1960 was only 40 years, but in those 40 years, a hell of a lot took place in Western civilization. You had World War I, you had World War II, you had the rise of communism. So by the end of World War II, with Europe being shattered, lots of people wanted to leave Britain. They wanted to leave Britain and Europe, and they were happy to move to Africa. So that brought quite a bit of a flood of people coming into Southern Africa, which helped to boost our population, especially the English population. So what happened was, after World War II, with all this weird communism that then started spreading to Asia, later to lead to the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff. The communists, the Russians, had been working behind the scenes to foment revolution across the British Empire. And the moment that World War II ended, this unhappiness now started becoming the main theme. Because the war is now over, Germans are now destroyed, and now the next problem arises, and the next problem is the black problem. So you've got suddenly across Asia, you've got Asians who want independence, Indians want independence, and in Africa, you want blacks wanting independence. So this nonsense already started by about 1948, and that started leading to problems. So what happened was, the Rhodesians were looking at wanting to get official independence from Britain then already. And it seems to me, as they were pushing for this independence, the British were kind of trying to push back. But it looks to me, and I'm still doing research, so I'm going to say some things. Maybe later I'll change my mind, but this is as I understand it now. And that these Rhodesians already, immediately after World War II, were starting to push for, we want to rule ourselves, we have been ruling ourselves, give us independence. You're saying that you're going to give some of these blacks independence, give us independence. And then what the British did was, they did a very strange thing. They came up with this idea of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, which was basically Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, and another little country called Malawi. So Northern Rhodesia is nowadays known as Zambia. Southern Rhodesia is known as Zimbabwe. So, but the most of the white population was living in Southern Rhodesia. So anyway, so the Rhodesians were kind of, I think they were kind of fooled, and they were fooled into, okay, we're gonna create this federation. It's almost going to be almost as powerful as South Africa. Not really, but maybe like a third as powerful as South Africa, hopefully. And it's this big piece of territory. It's going to be a British-ruled territory. Whites are going to rule it. And the theory behind it was that they are going to speed up the development of the black people. And the whole purpose, listen to this thing, because this is so ridiculous. The blacks were wanting independence, and the blacks were saying they want independence, and the British formed this entire thing that existed for quite a number of years so that the whites could build infrastructure and speed up the development of these black countries that are now known as Zambia and Malawi. And so, and the whites from southern Rhodesia were the driving force and were exporting like their technology and their expertise, etc., to build those countries faster. And you know why? To make the blacks so that the blacks don't want to leave. So the blacks want to stay in the Federation. We are already heading down towards we want a multiracial country, and we need to keep the blacks happy. Otherwise, they will want to break away to do their own thing.
So you're telling me that even when the roadies built their these blacks a fantastic infrastructure in society and civil and societies, that they still flocked to the white communities and societies?
Well, b basically, what happened was you must remember that Malawi and Zambia were a lot more backward than Rhodesia itself, in the same way that Rhodesia is much more backward than South Africa. But yes, the Rhodesians built lots of infrastructure. They helped to get infrastructure and speed up things for blacks. Blacks were promoted. Blacks were even promoted and made junior government ministers in the Federation. So they did all these liberal things, all the liberal stuff that you people are doing, that like the Canadians are doing and the British are doing now, and that you people in America have been doing by promoting blacks and getting them into as senators and mayors. The whites were doing that in the Federation in the 1950s. Well, guess what? After doing that for I can't remember how many years the Federation lasted, but after doing that for a couple of years, guess what? The blacks said, "No, we want independence. We want nationalism. We want nationalism." They're not interested in living with the whites and living better. They want to control their own countries. So that then resulted in the breakup of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. And so Northern Rhodesia, the blacks said, "We want to rule ourselves immediately now." And the same happened with Malawi. Now, when the British had managed to talk the Southern Rhodesians into this Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, they had said a couple of strange things. The British had said, "Nobody will be allowed to secede. Once this thing starts, this thing stays." But the next thing is, a couple of years later, the blacks are causing a ruckus and the blacks are protesting and all that kind of stuff. And these blacks now want out. They want to own it and run it all themselves. So the British then say to the blacks, "Oh, okay, now you can have it." So the British are basically breaking their own promises. And the white Rhodesians are saying, "But hold on, you said, there's going to be no secession, but if you're allowing secession and independence for the blacks, then why don't you let Rhodesia have independence?" So now the British are caught. And it's a long, complicated story, but that'll give you some of an idea of this political debate that went on between the whites of Rhodesia and the whites in London, and how this whole thing then fell apart. So the British then gave Northern Rhodesia independence, and it became Zambia, and it was a black country run by blacks, and they did the same to Malawi. But now here are the whites of Southern Rhodesia saying, "Well, give us independence too." But the difference is that Southern Rhodesia is run by whites. Now the British say, "Well, We'll give you independence, but you got to bring black people into the parliament and so on and so forth. So that is how this game played out.
And isn't that when Ian Smith was, of course, he said it originally, and then the media went crazy on it, and no black majority rule in 1,000 years, and then Wilson declared that act illegal, and that's when the sanctions were dropped.
Yes, so the bottom line is that after all this debate and wrangling that continued for years, the whites in Rhodesia eventually realized that, there's no ways the British are going to let them off the hook. What is quite interesting is that the Portuguese and the South Africans also were busy being concerned by all the violence because the Russians were already busy in Africa. You'd already had problems in Kenya in the 1950s. Whites had been killed in Kenya. You'd
Yes.
already had problems in the Congo. There'd been lots of war and fighting in the Congo. So Portugal was already seeing, oh God, because also prior to this, prior to the breakup of the Federation, the British then came in 1960 and they said, we are handing over all of our empire. And that thing of handing over the entire empire back to the quotes indigenous people, that is the thing that unleashed much of the violence. The Russians made the most of that. Sorry.
Wasn't that the Winds of Change speech given
Yes.
in
Yes, the
and
Winds of
presented
Change
in Cape
speech.
Town?
Yes.
And that was given by Wilson himself, or was that someone else?
That was Macmillan. Macmillan gave it.
Like no.
And
Okay. Yeah,
then
that was Britain admitting to the world that we're done, we're pulling out, you're on your own. Type of just an announcement, giving up everything that they've built over centuries of hard work.
exactly. Interestingly enough, a separate little topic to keep in mind is that after World War II, for a short while, the British were encouraging white British to move to Kenya. And the white population of Kenya farther north was actually still also increasing. So there's all kinds of stuff that happened that changed within very short periods of time. But the bottom line is that Ian Smith and them and the various prime ministers and the white politicians in Rhodesia looked at all these things and eventually they decided, you know what, if we don't do something, we're never going to get a chance and the British will never allow us. And so they actually connived a bit. Ian Smith actually even went to see Salazar, who runs Portugal, and he spoke to him. And he hit it off well with Salazar, who was a fascist. And so Ian Smith then went and they did UDI. But they knew that UDI is rebellion against Britain. Britain could come with military force, etc. So, the fact that they managed to pull off UDI without getting bombed and killed, that in and of itself was a thing that required a lot of balls, a lot of courage, and they pulled it off
Yes.
successfully.
I've never thought about it like that. That not only, they had a chance of being completely invaded, though it would have been hard to get Southern Africa to help participate in that. So all they did was just essentially use their navy, the Royal Navy, to surround and stop things from coming into and coming out of Rhodesia.
They did do more, actually. There are all kinds of weird things that happened. Listen to this. So now you've got the white country to the south of Zambia now rebelling. The next thing you know is Kaunda, the black president of Zambia, goes to Britain and asks Britain to protect him from the white racists in southern Rhodesia, in Rhodesia. And the British send their British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, went to Zambia and patrolled the border of Zambia for several years to, quotes, protect these blacks in Zambia from the, quotes, white racists of Rhodesia. Doesn't that just strike you as crazy?
What a waste of resources. What a waste of manpower. I mean, holy Jesus.
You know something? If there is a video that I did where I discussed that and I even put out some of the evidence about it, it'll blow your mind. And do you know that the RAF pilots, who were all white, of course, the RAF pilots who were flying the patrols on the border, they had to talk to the main airport that like controlled all the air traffic in the region was actually Salisbury. So even though they're in another country, that there isn't an airport that it can actually control all the aircraft. They don't have the radars and the technical ability. So the Rhodesians, the RAF had to talk to the Rhodesians. But the joke, listen to this, race comes through at the end of it. At the end of every year, the RAF pilots and crews used to get together with the Rhodesians, the white Rhodesians, and they'd party. They're there to fucking protect the blacks, but at the end of the day, everybody knows who's white and they get along. They know each other. They know they're never going to shoot at each other. It's the most ridiculous thing. There's a special video about it. It's the video I think the video where I deal with it the most is the one about why the British did not invade Rhodesia. And the short answer to it is that Rhodesians supported Britain so much and fought so much in every war that the British wanted them in that when the Prime Minister Wilson went to the generals and the top military people in Britain and said to them he wants them to invade Rhodesia, all the top military brass in Britain said no. They said, no, we're not invading Rhodesia. These people fought alongside us. We're not going to go and fight them, period. That is why, at the end of the day, that is all that Wilson could do. So there's some interesting and fun and good lessons in that.
That's utterly hilarious. The fact that the RAF would have to take off from Rhodesian airports and runways to then go fly over to the other side of the border to protect the blacks from the fictional white racist threat, then land back at the Rhodesian airport.
Sorry,
That's
I described that wrongly. They did fly from places in Zambia, but they didn't have radars. They didn't have radars that could control the whole region. So they would take off and land in Zambia, but when they needed to do like air traffic control, they had to liaise with Salisbury. Sorry.
Oh,
But
gotcha. Gotcha. Okay.
the whole thing is fucking crazy, eh? It's just nuts.
That's ridiculous. It's so sad as to how quick the British are willing to comply with a fictional threat from some African nonsense country about a racist white Rhodesian fictional threat. It's crazy. Yeah, that's something else. Wasn't Rhodesia, and it had about 200,000 population at the declaration of UDI in 1965, right?
Yes, it was about 200,000, and it may have gone up to about a quarter of a million or close to 300,000 for short periods of time. The white population actually did increase for quite a few years because despite sanctions, despite all the negative stuff, there were whites who were saying, hey, we like this place. And other whites were actually immigrating for a while. For the first 10 years, it actually went very well. Despite all the sanctions, despite all the problems. But we must admit also that Rhodesia could not have survived if it wasn't for Portugal and South Africa watching our backs.
Yes.
Without them,
Yes.
we wouldn't have been able to survive.
And from my understanding, listening to you, it was up until 1974 in the Carnation Revolution, coup d'etat in Portugal, that all the white southern African countries were winning overall. The Rhodesians had there wasn't any attacks. No white people were being attacked in Rhodesia. Southern Africa was pretty much peaceful. The Angolans and in Mozambique, everything mostly was under control. And am I correct in saying that?
You understand exactly correctly what was going on. Yes, absolutely so. That until 1974, all these threats and sanctions and terrorism and Russian activity and Chinese activity, despite all of that, the whites were still winning everywhere in southern Africa. And I am still going to do a video about how close white people came to winning and keeping southern Africa. That's going to
Yes.
blow your mind.
And it was really interesting. You brought up the idea that when Mozambique fell, that there was an idea floated around that the southern half of Mozambique could have been combined into Southern Africa or Rhodesia. I always thought that was an interesting idea that was never pursued. I wonder why. It's a little weird, but the whites were winning all over. They had full control, and it was a real white man's Wild West style feel. Here's a platform that we could do something on. So let's see what we could achieve and farm. And that's what Rhodesia ended up being. Weren't they the biggest wheat exporter in all of one of in all of Africa?
I don't think wheat, because South Africa, I think, also does wheat. I don't know about wheat, but Rhodesia was a big food exporter all round.
Okay.
South Africa's
I'm
also a huge is huge as an exporter, simply because there are more people here. But for its size and for its small population, Rhodesia packed a punch.
exported. That's the fact. Compared to other African nations who have to import everything they freaking get, being an exporter with only about 250,000 people is a huge accomplishment, especially with the amount of sanctions placed on by the, was it the UN and Britain?
Yes, United
And
Nations. It was comprehensive world sanctions by the United Nations.
yes,
Britain specifically asked the United Nations for everybody to put sanctions on Rhodesia, and it was pretty much true for most everything. There were some exceptions, and even America was an exception in certain things, like chrome, which is a strategic weapon, a strategic material. Chrome, which is a strategic material, America bought chrome from Rhodesia despite it being under white rule. And then when it went to black rule, America still continues buying chrome. So as long as America can get chrome, America doesn't care who runs the country.
And that's wow. And that's really one of the biggest parts of Southern Africa. I remember you mentioning that there's over 43, that was in 2018, there's over $43 trillion worth of natural resources and minerals in the ground, and there's only certain things that you can get from South Africa and former Rhodesia. Only certain things. If I'm not mistaken, America is still reliant on South Africa to get chrome. I don't know how much how truthful that is this late into the 21st century, but it's so important to the rest of the world. If you control South Africa, you really have a grasp on the world and humanity's resources. Maybe not oil to a certain extent, but the important ones that get everything in between, from cobalt to chrome to tungsten, everything.
Yes, if you take Africa from South Africa up to the Congo, up to Zaire, between Zaire, which is at the equator, and South Africa, you have got like the Middle East. You've got the Middle East of minerals in that area. This place is seriously rich. And the Russians, the Soviets knew it, and that's why the Soviets focused on this region as the place to create trouble and to overthrow the whites. Was because not because they cared about blacks, but because they knew the insane wealth that's lying in the ground.
Do you suspect that's why they were here there in Johannesburg or Cape Town in 1921, setting up the first outside Russia Communist Party? That was first Communist Party outside of Russia wasn't that 1921 in Cape Town or Johannesburg, South Africa?
Yes, that is so. Somebody said to me that it wasn't the second, it was the third. But anyhow, that was started though by by some, I think by either Englishmen or Englishmen and Jews. But it was basically, let's call it a British thing that started. So, and
Yeah.
that just kicked off. But
Let's face
that didn't have Russians involved. But they
it.
later then went to the Russians. They are the voices of the Russians, but they're actually English, the original Communist Party.
Yeah,
White English.
and communism is almost synonymous with Jews. I remember listening to your presentations, and the early Communist Party in Southern Africa wasn't interested in black Southern Africans. They were interested in whites. And but I wonder if that's how early they knew how important Southern Africa was in the mineral game and the natural resource game. But yeah, and Rhodesia, though, it's let me see here. And so you're in Cape Town these days, or are you in Johannesburg?
No, I'm in Johannesburg.
Johannesburg. Okay, cool. And let's see here. See, where were we? Sorry, we were on the UDI and the Carnation Revolution. Oh yeah, busting sanctions. Busting sanctions was a was. It seems like Rhodesia found that a little easier than easier. Whether it was dressing up their planes at foreign airports to do trades with millionaires or throwing a coup d'etat in the Comoros Islands with the French, they were able to get around all sorts of sanctions
I can comment on that, is that yes, there were people who started. There was a particular guy who owned like a small fleet of aircraft, and then he became the main sanctions buster of Rhodesia, and so he would then send his planes to various places, mostly to Europe actually, and they'd fly into places in Greece and Italy and where have you, and they'd actually load up with a whole bunch of cargo. Could be meat, could be anything, and they go and then they go and they trade, and yeah, they were doing that kind of stuff. South Africa later did similar stuff as well in a much more organized way, in the same way that the CIA has got like a secret fleet of aircraft. So too did the South Africans have a similar thing, but in Rhodesia it was this sanctions busting guy, and people were. We had arrangements with the Portuguese so that we could sell or use Portuguese companies as the front for our exporting. But the same thing
Yes.
between the Portuguese and the South Africans, we basically had open doors to their markets. Plus, then the sanctions busting on top of it was like Rhodesians dashing off mostly to Europe. And then they go and they sell things there quickly on the sly. And they had no
Yeah.
problems. Europeans had no problems with it, you know. The
Yeah, it is.
overthrow of that Comoros Island is actually a project between Rhodesia, France, and South Africa, where some Frenchmen said these Frenchmen who were fighting for Rhodesia came up with the idea of let's overthrow that Black Island, and let's use that as like a backdoor. And the Rhodesians liked the idea. The French government gave the thumbs up. The South African government gave the thumbs up. So Rhodesia flew the Frenchmen to the Comoros Islands, and they overthrew the government. And that became another backdoor for France, South Africa, and Rhodesia. It was quite a
Yeah, probably.
quaint little exercise.
That I was looking into that island nation. That overthrow probably couldn't have been that hard or that difficult. Well, clever white South Africans evading nonsense sanctions. It's absolutely nonsense. There was something I wanted to ask you earlier, that when you said almost at the beginning, I was wondering about the Rhodesian military early on. And between the Boers and the Englishmen who made up the country, was there any unusual ratio? Was the military made up of Boers or British primarily, or blacks primarily fighting for Rhodesia? I know that blacks fighting in the name of Rhodesia is a topic I wanted to cover because it's a weird one, and it's a big one. Was the military made up of mostly Boers or what?
It depends on which part I suppose you speak about, but let's talk about the professional army, the RLI, the Rhodesian Light Infantry, the Zulu Scouts, and the SAS, the SAS. The RLI and the SAS were pure white, and the people who went into it were the whites who lived there locally. So I think that as a rule, that the Boers would have been just the same sort of ratio in those units. But it is interesting that you will find a couple of Boers appear in places more for publicity purposes and not because they are Boers, but they ended up being just the poster children for the Rhodesian army. So, for example, it turns out like the guy who was the main recruiter for the Rhodesian army was actually a Lamprecht, a guy from our family, a distant relation. We never met him, but
Really?
Major Lamprecht was the main recruiter for the Rhodesian army. And there are some posters, and there's a statue of the
Like a troopy.
troopie. And
Yeah, a troopy. I was about to say it. Yeah.
But the troopie, actually, it turns out that the troopie is actually a Boer guy. They picked that guy as the main guy, as the sort of model for the troopie statue. But there's also some photos. There are also some photos of a soldier, and he's got his hands up with his V for victory sign.
Yeah, I
And
remember
that's
that
all.
one.
It also turns out that guy was also a Boer. So they were around.
Yeah, that I remember on that part of your Canadian presentation that if you really want to show the bruteness of yet how cool you could look while serving the Rhodesian military. I swear that troopie, the guy who modeled for that troopie model, could look like he can kick you, just break you with one kick, man. But that's awesome. That's really awesome. And in terms of blacks who fought for Rhodesia, because this is a supposedly white supremacist abusive state that doesn't take care of blacks, to the foreign eye, and but yet they had lots of blacks fighting for them, whether it was the Bushmen, I figure, who didn't like the Zulus, or were former communists, or one of my personal favorites, the Renamo fighters. Can you go into a little bit more detail about blacks who would have fought in the name and maybe why they would have fought and how loyal were they truly?
Okay, yes, the main unit, there was a unit called the RAR, the Rhodesian African Rifles. That was a black unit, but a black unit commanded by white officers. So you have a black unit, all the troops inside the unit are black, except their commanding officers are all white. And those blacks, blacks in Africa didn't see the blacks in Africa weren't totally stupid in their analysis always of things. There were debates between blacks as to whether black rule would be better than white rule, and there were blacks who told other blacks that it is better to be ruled by white people than to be ruled by black people. That kind of debate is something that you never hear about. And the black communists who eventually came to power in Africa were ruthless. When they found another black who was pro-white, they didn't go and debate with him, they'd kill him. And so you have all these liberals telling you, oh, well, this and this, and if the blacks were like this. Meanwhile, the reality is the quotes, black nationalists come and murder those who are against their ideology. They fucking kill them. And so you must know that for the blacks, blacks might not have been that loyal and that determined to fight for the whites, but they could get a great job. a great job with good career prospects from the state, and they may have that may be enough, good enough for them. There were maybe a handful who were much more loyal, and but it was there, but they are not as loyal as the white troops. For the white troops, it's I'm fighting for my country. For the black, he's not too worried. If the whites lose, he can go to the other side. In fact, there's so all this liberal stuff that they teach you, but the truth is that yes, there are lots of blacks who are armed, and they do as their white masters tell them to do. And South Africa functioned in the same way. There are blacks who fought for apartheid South Africa.
And they're also the mercenary effect, they fight for anyone. But I mentioned that you mentioned the blacks killed blacks who were friendly to the whites. I'll tell you, they didn't just kill them, shooting into a pit type of thing. It was the most brutal, heinous behavior, whether it's going and getting a necklace, and I'm not talking going down to the jewelry store. I'm talking about having a tire filled with petrol and burned around your neck type of thing. And I've seen some of the pictures. Communism's already barbaric enough, but when you mix it with Africans, it's some of the most heinous behavior I think I've ever seen on from yeah,
Yeah,
especially with the interracial violence.
and I must tell you that some of the things that have happened to whites, I remember my brother, for example, at a point during the war, my brother told me about another farmer, because my brother lived in a small town called Marandelas, and another farmer in that area was caught and killed by the terrorists. And my brother actually came one day, and he said to my parents, and he said, "You know what? When the blacks caught that guy, they hung him upside down and they hamstrung him, and that is he was hamstrung and left for a time before they eventually got around to killing him." So the cruelty of these people is horrific, And they are nasty. I've got other photos that I've not even published. There are many things to still put in videos where you'll see what they do. And that thing of cutting blacks' lips off, cutting their lips off and cutting their ears off, that's very much a Rhodesian thing. The blacks in Rhodesia did that stuff. The necklacing was more South African stuff. The South African style was necklacing, but in Rhodesia it was cutting and ripping their lips off their body and their ears and that kind of thing. These people are disgusting. They are brutal. And then everyone's like, "Oh no!" And all the liberals are standing up and defending them. "Oh no, this is good. This is right."
And they're doing all that with communist weaponry and
Yes.
coming
Yes.
from China and Russia and sometimes coming from the West. But it's absolutely heinous. And there's some of that, a lot of that behavior actually turned blacks to fight for whites. They have, it was a lot of the people, from my understanding, a lot of the blacks who were loyal and would fight to the death for whites were the ones who had their families chopped up and massacred with pangas, what you Americans, my fellow Americans, would call machete, and chopped up to bits and beheaded. And it's truly disgusting. And and I remember what you talked about between that happened between the Portuguese and the blacks, which tended to be the worst of the worst in all of Southern African violence. And that I remember pretty much how their principles in society may have fed into that, how the Portuguese let, actually incentivized and promoted interracial marriage. And, maybe there was something to do with that involved. But, how you mentioned how the worst of the worst when it came to black on white violence was in the Portuguese colonies, if I'm not mistaken. Is this correct?
Absolutely so. The Portuguese had the nastiest stuff, and I sometimes think that it's because there are different relations. You could argue as to this is when you get down to the finer points of life. How did a white Rhodesian treat a black compared to the Portuguese? Among the things that I kind of picked up was that although the Portuguese were much more lax on the sex stuff, they could be much more harsh. They could be much more harsh and domineering to the blacks as well. So there are some more subtle human dynamics which played into this.
Yeah, and for a comparison, correct me if I'm wrong. Remember that battle you mentioned, I forget what it was, but it was the last mass attack where the blacks had on the Portuguese, and it was 30,000 to 5,000 and
Carmona.
several, yeah, Carmona. And what the Portuguese didn't seek and destroy individuals in charge. They went in on a black massacre. They went on a black ass-kicking spree. And in comparison to the Rhodesians, I feel like they would have been with the Sioux Scouts more tactical with it. Maybe I don't know if that's an accurate comparison, maybe, but yeah, I remember how the Portuguese really handled that battle after the military was able to catch up.
That topic is a very interesting topic, and I'm busy working on a video about why white men lose wars. And in there, I'm discussing these kinds of things more closely. But yes, the interesting thing is that the Portuguese civilians, not the Portuguese army, the Portuguese civilians, once they got angry and they were furious that their own families had been killed, etc., then it was gloves off and they kill every black they come across. And it was amazingly effective. They were more effective than entire armies. But that's got to do with the difference between
Sir.
military and civilian.
Yes, sir. That's you gotta show them the boot. Some righteous anger. Put them back in their place. And I don't think that the Rhodesians or South Africans would have ever handled that in any handled it like that at any point. I think that there's a lot more restraint that comes from the South African and Rhodesian people. That's something else. The campaigns that the Rhodesians went among to fight the Russians and the Chinese from getting their tanks. And, their neighbors, they didn't care. They didn't ask permission to chase down black terrorists when they ran into Mozambique or when they ran back into, Zambia. They just chased them and they did what they want. They did what they wanted. If there was bridges that the black terrorists were using in Mozambique to get their troops and tanks across, and they'd blow it up, and they'd even bring black economies next door to a halt for years because of these incredible actions of the Sioux Scouts, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
The efficiency of the Rhodesians is kind of mind-numbing, as a matter of fact. And then they pretty much went home at the end of the day, kind of like a hunt, almost.
there is a lot more cooperation between the whites in southern Africa than one realizes. It took me quite a while to dig and to dig deeper into these things. Those bridges that were blown, although the Rhodesian army took the credit for it, there were actually South Africans from South Africa in there as well. It was that may have been a more of a white project. There were battles where there is something that I've discovered since I did my videos and since I did that talk. Is that I have uncovered that there was some kind of secret military alliance between Portugal, Rhodesia, and South Africa. And that alliance allowed them to call on each other. And South Africa was like the main power that could be called on. And there is a specific battle. There was one time when the Rhodesians specifically came to South Africa and asked South Africa to for the South African army to come and fight alongside the Rhodesian army. You might remember that story that I told about that stupid Bishop Abel Muzerewa. Now, that stupid Bishop Abel Muzerewa, that's complete fool, okay? Now,
Oh, yeah.
the good fool, let's call him the good fool, okay? The good fool who doesn't know, he has no clue what the hell he's doing, okay? But the reason
Yeah.
he's in South Africa is because of General Peter Walls. General Peter Walls is actually coming to South Africa. This is what I've been able to piece together. This is my best guess.
Peter Walls wanted to come to South Africa so he could speak to the South African military because he needed military help immediately. There was a big battle that was fought in southern Mozambique where the Rhodesian army and the South African army fought together against a massive concentration of blacks. That was like one of the last battles that was fought. It was probably the biggest battle of the Rhodesian War.
Was that the battle with all the rattles and the tanks and the T-50s, or is that something else?
No, you're probably thinking something. Of Angola. I actually didn't mention that battle in that presentation. That battle is something else. I need to actually maybe deal with it separately one day. But it was a big battle, and the South African Army and Air Force dived in because there were quite a few South Africans who were killed because their helicopters were shot down. So that was one.
And this was one of the last. This was one of the last, if not the last, big battle of the Bush Wars.
Yes, one of the last, if not the last, and it was in southern Mozambique. I'd have to go look it up.
And it wasn't just a little skirmish. It was a doozy.
It was big. It was everything that the Rhodesians could throw at it, and everything that the South Africans could bring as well. It was a big one.
I look forward to you achieving and skirting around the details of that. The battle, the efficiency of white soldiers and white armies in southern Africa is astonishingly amazing. Outnumbered with inferior weapons and inferior guns, able to take out Soviet tanks. Of course, they're being armed and driven by blacks, so we have a little bit, take that into account, but... I urge people to check out some of the videos of yours and the presentations of yours I have, and it talks specifically about the efficiency and how well the Rhodesian and South African armies performed. And to comment on like Bishop Muzorewa and the uselessness, I think we'll cover that next time in part two, the Christianity and how much the Rhodesians and South Africans had to put out to ensure they were okay, and it was just turned out to train these black armies in the black villages and the rural zones to protect themselves and build up all this stuff, and at the end of the day they would hardly they would fall or they'd just be killed, and it just cost the Rhodesians even more time and money and manpower to take care of them. And then there's Bishop Muzorewa, who signs away South Africa it's hard to remember all these new black characters and important people in my life. Sometimes I mix up some of these important names. Hell, like Tokyo Sexwale or something like that. I mix them all up, and
it's not an easy topic. It's not a culture that you're familiar with. So I do understand. Don't worry about it. But the whites are treating these blacks like our local civilians, but there's more to this than meets the eye. But the whites have to function at a great disadvantage. And returning to the efficiency, because that's what you were talking about, the efficiency of our small armies and our small militaries is quite stunning, and that was one of the things that I thought about, especially among you younger people in the white right, because thanks to Jewry, all of you have got lifetimes where there are more and more non-whites, especially black Africans, in your freaking countries who weren't there originally, and People in the white right have been talking about racial conflict, racial war. What do you do when you're outnumbered? And that was when I thought to myself, I really need to tell them about us in Africa, that if you really have a race war and it's really down to white versus black, that, don't be too afraid. The white man can kick ass way above his weight level, more than you would believe. And lots of things in your country, you know, lots of things in America and the West fool you. They fool you into thinking that those people are your equals. But if those people were in their own society, making their own decisions, organizing in their way, they wouldn't be a patch on whites organizing in their society, sticking together. And that's a big lesson that even the whites in Southern Africa have started to lose. If I may just point to something, I think recently a General Brown was promoted to a very high rank in America. I think his name is Brown. And I'm not sure if he's going to be the chief of staff, if he's going to replace General Mark Milley. I think so. Mm. And but okay, you might not have taken note of it, but I want to tell
I
you something.
I've never heard it.
This general that's being promoted was promoted by Biden, and Biden promoted a black guy. So this is a black guy, but listen to this. This is a black guy, and they say, oh, no, he flew, I'm not sure if it's stealth aircraft or whatever. And then I'm thinking to myself, you know, how much of it is his skill and how much of it is white computer technology? You know, take, for example, World War II. Was it the Tuskegee Airmen or something?
Yes, Tuskegee Airmen, who they like to make a big deal about, and the Buffalo Soldier Squadron on the ground, who they like to make a big deal about.
Right. Now, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there was a white squadron of white guys who actually flew behind the Tuskegee Airmen to actually protect them. That is what a guy from the American, that's what one of the old guys from the American Nazi Party told me when I was in America. He said to me that what they don't tell you is that the blacks were protected by whites. That because those blacks would have been mincemeat for the Germans.
Wow, that's embarrassing. It wouldn't be shocking to hear that. I'll tell you what, I know that as of late, I found out, I don't know if you're familiar with the American nonsense story of Emmett Till and the over-exaggerated death of him. But, you know, his father was a black soldier who fought in Italy in World War II, and he raped and killed three women in Italy, and they hung him high. And these Buffalo soldiers and these Tuskegee Airmen have so much wind blown up their rear ends. But, yes, that's hilarious that you bring up that story. That's I'm going to look more into that. I heard a story once. It was brought into me in my Telegram chat about how when Rhodesians and South Africans would take out a black terrorist squadron, ZAPU, ZANU, they would collect their weapons and find their AKs and their rifles with their rear sight dials turned all the way up, all the way to the yardage. And they were thoroughly confused by this. And they asked the blacks why they were doing this. Why do you have your rear diameter sight set to 800 meters. Well, the blacks thought that this made their AKs more powerful. And they thought that the gun shot harder when they turned up the diameter sight. So, you know,
I've never heard that story before, but these things are possible. One thing I do know is that many soldiers have commented on the bad black shooting abilities that they
Yeah.
In fact, if I may add to this, here's a story that'll blow your mind. I've been trying to find this again, but I think they've removed this from the internet. In Africa, in Nigeria, shortly after Nigeria, up in West Africa, that big African country in West Africa, after they got independence, there was a group of blacks in Biafra who broke away from them. Right.
Yeah, that's
so now listen to this. I've heard this said, and I remember this comes from credible sources. Unfortunately, I can't find the original sources, but multiple people who are aware of it have pointed this out. Do you know that in the Biafran War, which lasted about 2 years, I think it was like 2 years or so, do you know that they say they fired more rounds of ammunition in that war than everybody in World War II put together.
No way. No, that's crazy.
I'm not joking. I've come across this, and you know who else has mentioned this thing? Is Dr. Peter Hammond in South Africa. He also has raised this issue. I don't know the original source, but I have also come across it, that more rounds of ammunition were fired in the Biafran War by the Nigerian army than all the armies put together in World War II. Just think about that.
So that's a lot of skinnies with AKs popping up and just shooting up over the hill.
Just
that's a lot of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And just
watch some of these fights and some of these blacks even now, and you'll see all kinds of weird things. I saw another thing recently, a little bit off the thing, and we must wind up shortly anyway, but I saw once a video where in recent times in a black African country, some black guy climbed on a vehicle and there was another guy with a rifle and the guy was just firing. And then suddenly the guy just pulls off a shot and the other guy drops dead off the fucking vehicle.
Yep. I've seen that video. That's a big Russian Soviet machine gun. And it's the lack of... Oh, I don't want to say lack of evolution, but you know, the lack of awareness is just absolutely crazy. it's white man's technology that they're just abusing. But that's
also why I point out the inefficiency and stupidity of these people, and I say that's why we shouldn't fear them. You know, go and test these people. You know, what is one afraid of? It is these people are being protected and made to appear successful when in fact they're total failures.
And like you've said, they're permanently unhappy people that are just never going to be happy ever. And I circles back all the way back to the first episode I ever watched of yours. And I sent that link originally when I emailed it to you. You talked about just how, like, every problem that they've faced, you know, ever since, you know, the housing problem that old gentleman that you talked about in that video, you could have solved all of this, but, you know, 5 million houses and how many years it was, Mandela said, but, you know, it's efficiency of whites is second to none, and we've proven that, and, you know, we will have to be wrapping it up here shortly, but I want to ask you something, just kind of a fun question here. I have some dog people in my family. Do you ever had a Rhodesian Ridgeback?
in the case of my family, no, we haven't had a Rhodesian Ridgeback. But Rhodesians were amazing dog lovers, and Rhodesians had lots of dogs. And whites in Africa generally are quite into dogs, but Rhodesians especially. I can remember people having like dogs in their car, three or four dogs in their car. In Rhodesia, people really loved animals a lot. It's a white feature, and whites look well after their animals.
Yeah,
the black animals are always skinny.
With the farm attacks, you know, you have to have four to ten dogs on the property, and it's kind of in a rumor here in America that blacks are afraid of dogs, and you know, got to have one. They're fantastic. And I've enjoyed this talk, Jan. We're got to be wrapping it up here. We're about an hour and a half, and so I want to thank you for being on here. And eventually, we're going to have a part two, and we're going to get more into Rhodesians' fight and the fall of Rhodesia, and eventually. But is there anything that you'd anything else you want to finish up on? Anything else that you want to say?
I can't think of anything offhand. I just think that I will also mention that I'm still digging and doing more research and putting out stuff about how the whites worked with each other, because the whites in Southern Africa liaised also with certain whites in Europe. And at the end of the day, the only whites that really helped us were whites in Europe, especially the French. And the whites of Europe were the only whites that we could turn to. And that's an important thing. And I want to do more videos on the relationships between the whites in Southern Africa and the whites in Europe. The British and the Americans didn't lift a finger. They just stood by and didn't care and didn't help at all. But there were Europeans who did try to help us, from Spain to Portugal to Italy to West Germany to France, etc. They were people we could turn to.
Good. Great. I look forward to that. And I look forward to that battle in southern Mozambique that you mentioned earlier. Any information that you gather on that, I look forward to. And let's leave it off with the fact that, you know, for white people, you need to keep hope, keep your hopes up. And like General von Manstein said, there's no desperate situations, only desperate people. And that was off one of your latest discussions you did, and of which I enjoyed. But Jan, I want to thank you, and we'll see you next time, okay?
Thank you very much. It's been an honor being on your show. Take care.
Thank you. My privilege. Thank you.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. Thank the Lord.